excellent example of how we have to see where the man is in the Bible saying that we should take an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That sounds very cruel for us. That means, for example, if I'm drunk and through my drunkenness I'm responsible for an accident in which you lose your right eye, my right eye should be poked out. If I'm responsible for your losing your leg, my leg should be cut off. That seems harsh to us, but it is very merciful. Before there was national law, all people had to defend them was the tribe, the clan, their family group. And there was something called blood vengeance. And this is how violence was controlled. If you unjustly hurt me, my tribe had a blood debt to avenge me against you. So they then would seek you out. And if you had just were responsible for something that you did to my eye, they weren't going to stop there. You know, because if they're battling you, they can't limit it to the eye. They'd kill you. However, the moment my clan kills you for the accident you've caused on me, your tribe now has a blood debt against my tribe. And now it's expanded from an accident that involved two people to a war between two families, a full-scale feud. And this is what happened in those days. The Bible, someone experiences God, and he just looks at this whole mess going from an accident where there was a little bit of damage between two people and then wars that involved two feuds that involved two families. He says, there's no way God wants this. Not the God I'm experiencing. He doesn't want his children doing that. So let's limit the damage. God's too merciful for that. Limit the damage to the harm. So against its background, the phrase an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was a great step forward of becoming more merciful, not becoming harsher. God touched a person where he was and brought him a step forward. So sometimes we have to go back and separate the ideas of the time from the teaching on God to understand them. Now, the big thing is to understand the Bible that I haven't commented on in any form at all is this phrase, how do you read the Bible? You got to really understand it. You must know. I'll give you the big word that scholars use, or the phrase, literary form. Literary form just means the kind of writing. And you've got to know this. This makes all the difference in the world. For example, and I like to use this as an illustration, I doubt if any, I know nobody's here has ever called up the intensive care ward of a hospital to find out how Jack and Jill are doing following their severe accident on the hill. Because you just don't do things like that. Jack and Jill, you just know there, you know, that there was no such people. There are kinds of writing. And there are kinds of writing in the Old Testament. But, well, let me start with this. Supposing we had a day nursery here, or a preschool group, and we wanted to give a lesson to the kids that they should look both ways before they cross the street. I could ask all of you if you would please try to think up something like as an individual. I could ask you as an individual, next 2 weeks from now, would you take an afternoon and get this message across to the kids? And depending on our talents, we could do it a variety of ways. If somebody had enough ability, they could write and sing a song where there'd be kind of some refrain about looking both ways and the kids hopefully would remember the melody. Somebody else had the talent, he could write a simple little play that would use the kids. He could write the play, involve the kids in it. Somebody else could just simply give a talk. And if the person was historically bent, he could do a lot of research in newspapers and just give the kids one story after another, all real, about accidents that occurred. Someone else could tell them a story, make up a story. much more alive and interesting than the real ones. These are all, well, this would be kinds of talking, but they are kinds of writing in English. And each could use the same English words differently. We have today many different kinds of writing that we're all familiar with. You pick up a magazine like any of the popular women's magazines or Argosy or something like that. All the articles aren't the same. Some will be fact and others will be non-factual. They'll be stories, fiction. And we automatically adjust. When you read a story, you don't confuse it with fiction. You can do the same with kinds of looking on television. When you watch a program after 7 o'clock, usually you don't confuse it with what you see during the news time. You don't really think that you're watching Starsky and Hutch do something, really being shot at literally. You see people getting shot at, however, on the news, and you think that's real. That this has actually happened. We adjust. Minds always do. So you're reading a magazine, you're reading a story that somebody wrote that isn't true, your mind just, you know, shifts off. You're not believing what you're reading, you're just maybe looking for a message, reading to be entertained. You read another kind of story where it is true, you read that one differently. So we have novels, we have poetry. You can have poetic license. Poets can say things that you and I aren't supposed to, that would be stupid if we said them. You could write history. You could write a play. You could write an essay. These are all different ways to make the same point in English. You could write a newspaper article. That has its own rules. See, they never know how much space they have for an article. So the way you write a newspaper article is way different from anything else. The first paragraph has to be everything most important. And every paragraph is numbered. It doesn't go in time sequence. It goes in importance of information. Because anywhere they may have to cut it. And wherever they cut, they want you to have received all the most important things up to that point. That's a very unique way of writing. Very, very different from history. A historian can cover an event, and a newspaper reporter will cover an event, and they'll write about it in very, very different ways. They're different kinds of writing. Okay. The Bible has its own kinds of writing. Very, very different. And they're very different from what we have today. And one of the great errors is we confuse the kinds of writing. That's where the whole problem comes. It's taking something like a poem, a Jack and Jill fairy tale or something, and taking it literally. We'll take a good look at this in the book of Jonah in a moment. For example, Jonah is not supposed to be taken as history. I'll show you reasons why. But most people that I know in the Enid area take the Jonah story literally and believe that a man named Jonah literally spent 3 days in the stomach of a whale. They cause unnecessary problems. And in doing this, if you don't understand the kind of writing, your attention will be focused on the wrong thing and you'll miss the point. By looking so much at the facts of the Jonah story, they miss the message of the Jonah story very often because they don't understand the kind of writing that it is. Unimportant details can be taken as the truth being taught. For example, the 7 days of creation. We'll get into this a little bit more next time. This is what is called a memory device, and I'll write the big word on the blackboard. It's a word I can't pronounce. M-N-E-M-O-N-I-C. It's a memory device. That's what it means. That's what the word's supposed to say. Look, remember that they didn't have books. Everything had to be handwritten. Most people never had a copy of something written in their hands. They developed their memories. And they had lots of neat little techniques to use to remember things. And if you examine the 6 days of creation, there's fabulous memory done here. The way the days parallel each other. It's just all a huge memory thing. When you get to 7, that's a complete number. You rest, you can shut it all off. What we're being taught is that one God, well, we'll look at this more. One God made everything good, and man different and above everything else. Those are the truths. Not that God made it in 7 days. That's not important. You don't need to know how many days God made this world to know that a good God is loving you, and in his love for you is salvation. You don't need to know how many days God made the world to know that you are good, that God made you good, that your body is good, it isn't evil. So celebrate it. You don't need to know the unnecessary. And unless we know the literary form, unless we see that this was a way of communicating a truth, like a fairy tale could be, or a short story, or an essay, or a play, unless we see the literary form, we'll mistake and get all hung up over the 7 days and miss the beautiful truths that are being taught that there's no problem with if you understand the literary form. Some literary forms are completely misunderstood, leading to huge problems. I was invited a while back when I was in Lawton over to a Baptist church for a Sunday, and we had a beautiful session, me and one of their Sunday morning Sunday schools, until they asked me a question on the book of Revelation or the book of Apocalypse, the last book of the Bible. Well, it didn't get bad, but we couldn't share it. I just had to look at them and tell them that we read this book so differently that we couldn't talk about it. It was impossible. It is nearly impossible for a Baptist, a Southern Baptist, both of us to talk about this book. I couldn't get out of that grammatically. Apocalyptic is the strangest of all of the forms of writing in the Bible. I'll give you a quick introduction to this. We are now in the year 1977. I hope you all know that. Apocalyptic is a neat little way of writing. You go back and you pretend like you're writing from a different date. Like I would go back to the year 1927 and say, listen, America, you are living. Now I'm pretending, I'm writing this right today, but I'll make it sound like I'm writing in 1927. And I'll say, listen, America, you are becoming too materialistic. You're worshiping all your material goods. And so because I love you, I'm going to take those goods from you. They're your gods now, but I tell you, your children are going to be begging for those gods in the street. I just predicted the Great Depression. But you're not going to learn. Because you can't find them at home, you'll go looking elsewhere. And so I tell you, your children are going to die on battlefields whose names you've never heard. I just predicted the First World War. But you won't learn. So I will send them to further fields. I've just predicted the Korean War. But you still won't learn. So I will send them once again to fields whose names you can't even pronounce. I've just predicted the Vietnamese War. Ain't I brilliant? Look at all I've been able to predict. You get this book and boy, you can scratch your head. Gee, isn't he great? And then I could make some other little statements and you think, well, if I've done so well, I've got to do better up here. And that's how the book of that's one of the big things of apocalyptic. It is written during the first great persecution of the church. It is written, great persecution. It is written to strengthen the faith of the church at a time when people are leaving it for the first time in great numbers. It sounds like it is written before any of the persecutions have occurred, and it is predicting all of them as they're going to happen. They've already happened. And its big point is to show that Jesus is total Lord of this whole scene, and he's going to end up victorious. So stick with the winners. It looks like Babylon, which is a symbol of Rome, the city of evil, looks like Babylon's winning because it's clobbering the good guys. But Jesus is Lord of history. That's one of the big things of apocalyptic. It does not predict. Apocalyptic is almost always, as far as we know, it has always been. It's written during times of persecution, when somebody else controls your land, so you got to be sneaky and devious. And you got to write in symbolic ways so your persecutors don't know what's going on. And this form is one of the ways to do it. It's a very, very unusual way. It is not basically predicted. So when these people like Garner Ted Armstrong, as far as I can understand him, I like to listen to him every so often, but he always knows what's going to happen, and it's always going to be predicted, see? It's all in the Bible. Well, it isn't there. The Bible isn't a huge Gene Dixon prophecy. Certainly not the book of the Apocalypse or book of Revelation, which is where most people turn for this, and Daniel. Daniel is apocalyptic. That's the other one they use for this. Has heavy apocalyptic elements. It's where this starts. So this is the strangest of all literary forms for us. There's many other very strange things about it that I've just shared the biggest one with you. Okay. Didn't get to sit down that time. Now let's get to my favorite book, the book of Jonah, as an example of this. Most of us were taught, as I share, to think that the book of Jonah is factual. If you had never heard anything, if you've never met a Christian, and I gave you two things to read, the story of the Good Samaritan and the book of Jonah, and I said, are these true? You would say, on reading the book of Jonah, no, this one's a story. And on the Good Samaritan, you would say, this one sounds true. But we turn them around. We know that the Good Samaritan is a parable, a story Jesus told to make a point. We don't know that the book of Jonah is the same. Technically, you could call it didactic fiction. That's a parable, a story with a message. The literary form, its kind of writing, is not factual. There's no attempt in the book of Jonah to teach a single historical fact. History has been manufactured, it's been contrived, it is bent, it is shaped, it is molded to make some fabulous points that I hope you'll see as we finish looking at the book. Nothing is lost in seeing this, and a lot of problems are just passed over. It's actually a satire against Jonah. Now, to go into the book of Jonah, you have this word of the Lord. God speaks to Jonah, and he says, listen, Jonah. Jonah's over here in Palestine. I want you to go to the city of Nineveh. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't find a map to bring over handily enough to show the whole world. The world would go a little bit further over to Spain, and then it ends. This is the whole world of the time, okay? I want you to go to the city of Nineveh, and I want you to tell them that they're acting up, and I'm going to clobber them. Nineveh is the symbol of everything that is evil. There is nothing in the world today that could rival it. Maybe 15 years ago, Peking could have. 25 years ago, Moscow could have. 35 years ago, Hitler's Berlin could have. Nineveh is the capital of Assyria, and the Assyrians had completely wiped out the 10 northern tribes of Israel, and they never came back. So it's the picture of everything evil. And Nineveh, its capital, is sort of the bed where all this happened. So, you know, this is like God telling you, bops into your life, and he says, hey, now listen, I want you to go to Peking. It isn't as bad today, but I want you to go to Peking and tell them they've got 40 days to repent or I'm going to clobber them. Yeah, well, sure, God. Well, you know, what else? You want me to stop in Moscow on my way and give them the same message in Romania? You know, it's a hopeless thing. So now the world's flat. God tells Nineveh, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. What does Jonah do? He gets on a boat heading to Spain. Now the world's flat. Jonah is going as far away from where God has sent him as he can go. He gets on the boat and a storm comes up. Please note that in the entire book of Jonah, everybody else comes out smelling like a rose. One person, start to finish, stinks. Jonah stinks. And start to finish, he's the only person who believes in the God of Israel. All the rest don't. The pagan soldiers, there's a storm. I mean the pagan soldiers, the pagan sailors all pray to their own local little gods. They all thought there were local gods, one for each city. So they're all devout enough in their relationships with their God to pray when there's a problem. What does Jonah do? He goes down and falls asleep. He knows that his is the God of the earth, the sky, and the sea. But he doesn't care. He's not a very devout man, so he falls asleep. The captain comes and looking for him, wakes him up. They cast the old lots, and they find out that Jonah's responsible. They find out that Jonah doesn't have a local God. He's got the big God. And they really get shook up that he's disobeying this God. But yet these pagans care enough for Jonah that they don't want to throw him over. They try their hardest to row him to shore, to still save his life. We're going to contrast that at the end with the attitude of Jonah. Jonah doesn't want to save the pagans. The pagans want to save Jonah. So Jonah is tossed over and he is swallowed by a big fish, not by a whale. There's a symbolism here. In the New Testament, Jesus calls the fish a whale. So there is a justification in that. But in the book of Jonah, the fish is never called a whale. It is a big fish. And that's important for the theology of the whole story. So Jonah gets swallowed by the fish. He spends 3 days inside the fish, and he's vomited back up on the land. God comes and he says, "Hey, Jonah, why don't you go to Nineveh?" Jonah is a very wise man. He figures if you can't beat him, join him. So he heads to Nineveh. He gets to Nineveh, and Nineveh is so huge, it takes him, it's a city that where it takes you 3 days to walk through. He gets to the middle of the city, and he says, this is his whole preaching. Yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. That's his whole message. And everybody immediately repents. The people immediately start off repenting. Word gets to the king. The king repents. He even orders the animals to fast and do penance. Everybody in the town's doing penance. Does this make Jonah happy? Nope. Jonah is furious. He goes storming out of Nineveh, and he sits outside. You see, this is one of the big points. Jonah suspected that Nineveh might repent. Wasn't much of a chance, maybe in like 1 in a million. But if it did, Jonah knew God well enough that Jonah probably wasn't going to sock it to him. And if there's one thing Jonah wants, it's that Nineveh gets it socked to it. Jonah wants Nineveh punished. And he just felt that they just might repent and God just would hold back that punishment. And it's happening and he's furious. And he goes outside and he's sitting there and he's looking at it. He's just burning. And he tells God he wants to die. He's just mad. See, that's why he bought the ship. He didn't want Nineveh saved. He wants Nineveh destroyed. So if he doesn't carry out his role, Nineveh's going to get destroyed. God then has a plant grow. He's sitting out in that good old desert sun, and this plant grows, gives him a little bit of shade, and then the plant dies, and that's it. Jonah says, "I've had it. That's the last straw. Kill me now." And God says, "Listen, you klutz. You're upset because I killed a plant that wasn't here yesterday. How do you think I feel about all those people in Nineveh? You didn't grow that plant. They're my people." And that's where the book ends. It seems as if Jonah lived around 800 years before Jesus, 700 to 800. The book is written 200 to 400 years before Jesus. It's really written almost 400 years after it pretends to be written. In the meantime, we can forget Nineveh a moment. In the meantime, Israel, God's people, really the southern state called Judah, also was conquered by Babylon and led off to Babylon for 40 years, which is a rough generation of exile. Babylon, I should have put them reversed, has as its symbol a fish. Jonah means dove, and dove is a symbol for Israel. God called a people to announce to the world that he loved the world. This people disobeyed God. They didn't accept his love, and so they didn't make the announcement. God led them into an exile in Babylon, and then Babylon vomited them back to the Holy Land, where God gives them the opportunity to announce the message again. At the time this book is written, all of this occurred around 588, I think. So about 500, nearly 600 years before Jesus is when this occurred. Following their defeat by Babylon, the Jewish people became snobs. They didn't announce God's love to anyone. They celebrated how great they were, that they had God as their private protection, and everybody else was going to get clobbered. They're living exactly what Jonah is doing here. And somebody experiences a God and says, hey, this isn't it. We've got it all wrong. And this message, exactly what happens to Jonah. Jonah, Israel, is swallowed by the fish, Babylon, for 3, a symbolic number of completion, years equaling the 40 years exile, because Jonah Israel was untrue to its vocation. Given a second chance, Jonah at least announced the message. Israel still isn't doing it. That's the warning. The communication is that God's love is for everybody, that the same God who was merciful to Jonah, who didn't clobber Jonah for disobeying his vocation, who didn't even remind Jonah of it. When Jonah gets brought back on the land, God just gives him a message and doesn't say, hey, I told you so. He just gives him a mission like he never gave it before. Israel has a mission of love. Someone experiences a God and he knows this God is for everybody. He knows this God is forgiving. And he knows this God can't be content with the snobbishness that the Jewish people are living at his time, and he tries to communicate this to the Jewish people to shake them out of the way they're living. That's the message of Jonah, and it's a great book. It's a fabulous book, and the message stands out so clearly, and it's a book with a sense of humor. It's one of the few books of the Bible that really does have a sense of humor, and it's great in this sense. This guy who experienced God wasn't lost in the awesomeness of God. He can laugh, and he can joke about it, and he can tell about God in a kind of funny way. Now, the ways we know that the story isn't history, there's lots of little things. First, where the Jewish people put the book. They don't put it with their history books. They put it with their prophetic books. Now, that doesn't settle the issue, because there are some books that they put with their history books that we don't call as history anymore, because we've learned more about how the books were written. But when you write history, you get a lot of unnecessary details. When you tell a parable, everything is telescoped to the point. And that's exactly what happens in the book of Jonah. That's why Jonah keeps stinking. That's why all these other people come out smelling good. Everything, nothing is told that doesn't lead toward the big conclusion, God's great love for everybody. Forgiving Jonah. You know, Jonah's being forgiven. Please don't miss that. Because the writer experiences a God of forgiveness. And you know, a lot of us think the God of the Old Testament was harsh. That's because we haven't read much of the Old Testament. Read the book of Jonah. There's no harshness in there at all. The guy who experienced God certainly doesn't have a God who in any way is unforgiving. There's no names. The name of the king isn't given. There's no specifications. These are things that are done in historical books. There's a beautiful sentence in here. First, the like historically we have no record of the conversion, that I liked. Never in all of history has a great city like Nineveh been converted by one short mission given by one missionary who spoke of a foreign God in a foreign language and who didn't want to convert his hearers anyway. It just isn't historical in any sense at all. So if you understand the literary form, you're not going to wonder about how Jonah lived in the belly. You're not going to wonder about any of these things. You'll be open to experience a God of universal love. The literary form of the book of Jonah. So, that's the first thing. We should try to get the literary form. If we want to go deeper and clear up some of the problems of the Bible. For example, the thing that gives most of us most difficulty are the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis. They have a very unique literary form. Genesis 1 to 11. Starting with Abraham, everything changes. But before Abraham, the literary forms of those stories is very, very different. And some of them we'll cover next time. Some we'll make some comments on now. Okay, so first, we got to understand the kind of writing the person's using. Does he expect you to take what he's saying as factual? It makes a big difference. Secondly, we've got to see that what God guarantees is limited to revealing God and our response. The Bible is not an encyclopedia. And that's the great error we make. It doesn't teach archaeology. It's not intended to tell you how old man is. It wants you to know that you're no accident, that God steps in and touches you uniquely, that you're different from all the rest of creation. Geology, it doesn't care about how old the world is. It does want you to know that everything in the universe flows from one God. So there aren't stars that should be worshipped, a moon that should be worshipped, a sun that should be worshipped. There aren't two gods, a God of good and a God of evil, as a lot of people had. Everything flows from the hands of one loving God. So everything is good. It's all his gift to you because you stand above it all. Doesn't tend to teach astronomy. You don't need these things to love God, how the universe is shaped. It's important to know that the universe was shaped by a God who loves you, and so on. You could take it all this way. So, on all of these other facts, on medicine, on history, even its historical facts, and there's many errors there, on all these facts, the Bible can be and often is wrong.